Okay, so we're going to go ahead and start this oral history. This oral history interview is in participation with the Recent Oral History Class of San Diego at the UC San Diego campus, taught by Professor Simeon Mann. Today I'll be interviewing Professor Judy Pataxil. She's the national president of FONS, and we're going to learn a little more about her today. So, Judy, when did your family move to the U.S., and what generation do you identify as?
My father first came in 1928. I had two documents. One said 27, one said 28, but I think 28 is about when he came. So he came when the United States was colonizing the Philippines, so when the Philippines was a territory, so he was able to come with, he was considered a national, and he came here for the purpose of getting a bachelor's, getting a degree actually. So in the Philippines he did get his undergrad, which is kind of, the school system there is a little bit different, but he wasn't an official pensionado, but he was like a pen boy. He had lots of promise, and the town people, the townmates, gave money and family to send him here to the Philippines to go to college, actually. And then the Great Depression hit, and so he was having some levels of difficulty with school, with the racism, and he actually was like a monong. He worked in the fields, even though he did have education there. I remember him telling these stories of how he would travel across the country on the trains. He would say, like a hobo. And so after the Great Depression hit, it was really hard, I think, for especially the Filipinos to find work. They were migrant workers at that time. World War II hit, and my dad went joined the U.S. Army and went back to the Philippines. So he actually served under MacArthur. He was a messenger from MacArthur, and was, you know, not his only messenger, but when he said that he was a special messenger. And I said, how come you never told us this? This was like when he was already close to, I think, his late 80s or early 90s. And he said, well, you never asked me. But I thought, wow, you know, he really represented so much history. He was a pen boy, he was a manong, he worked in the Alaskan canneries, so he was a Lascaro, World War II veteran, and again served. We have a picture of him where he's in Papua New Guinea. So when MacArthur left the Philippines and retreated and went to Australia and the Pacific Islands and Papua New Guinea, there's a picture of him in Papua New Guinea, my father, not with MacArthur specifically, but in Papua New Guinea. And after World War II, this is a long answer to your question, during World War II, he was looking for his sister, and his sister married into kind of an affluent family. My dad's background was farming. He's from La Union. So he was looking for his sister, and when he went to the town to where his sister married into this family, he saw my mom on the porch, and then his sister married my mom's brother. So that's how they met, and it was supposedly like love at first sight. But my dad was a lot older. He was like almost 15, I think almost 16, almost 17 years older than my mom. So he was of that generation. If he didn't get a Filipino, because of the anti-miscegenation laws, if he didn't get married or find a bride from the Philippines, he may have died like the Manong generation without family. So my mom and dad got married in 1946, and then they decided after the war he had U.S. citizenship. So he had like a civil service job over there in the Philippines, but they wanted to try life here. And so my oldest sister, they had a son who didn't survive, I think their firstborn son. And then my oldest sister my next oldest brother and my next brother. He was only less than a year. They all immigrated, came back because my dad had access to, he was a U.S. citizen. So they came back to the from the Philippines to the United States in 1950. So I consider myself second generation because my mom and dad were the first generation to come.
So were you born here?
I was born here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where did you grow up and where do you live now?
I grew up in Southeast San Diego. So my parents, that's where people of color were allowed to buy property, pretty much, in terms of redlining. So it was south of the 8, Southeast San Diego. So it was the hood. So that's where I grew up. There was, on the block, though, there were a number of Filipino families, because that's where many of the early pioneers were able to get property, was in Southeast. So I grew up between Ocean View and Imperial Avenue on 37th Street, and we probably had about maybe 8 families on that 37th Street from between those Ocean View and Imperial, somewhere close to that. So there was a small community of Filipino Americans in Southeast because that's where they first came, and my parents, my dad first came over by himself to get things set up, and then my mom and my siblings came. So there's a picture of them in Filipinos in San Diego of the arrival. So my mom was a war bride. In the Filipinos in San Diego book, there's a picture of the arrival of war brides, and that's my mom and the kids. I wasn't born yet.
In terms of San Diego back then and then San Diego back now, because I know you're mm-hmm. still here in San Diego, how has it changed in your own perspective? What do you see that are different? Mm-hmm. And what do you see that are the same? Even?
The same. Mm-hmm. Well, the Filipino community definitely is larger. Where I live now is up here closer to the college after I got the job here. I don't like traffic and commutes. So I moved here to Mira Mesa, and then I moved to Scripps Ranch. And so I still have my home in Scripps Ranch, but was recently married, and my husband has a home in Tierra Santa. So we have 2 homes, and I have to sell my house. So I live up here now. So up here, when I moved here, it was called Manila Mesa. So there was a lot of Filipinos. And back when I was growing up, there were not as many Filipinos. I mean, the community was small, and there was some level of somewhat cohesiveness in that they gathered for the Filipino events, and there were the Filipino organizations. Like, my mom was very involved in the Filipino Women's Club, and my dad, because of Ilocano, so they were both in the Ilocano Friendship Club, and they were the veterans, another veterans organization, and there was a hall in Southeast San Diego called the FAVA Hall, Filipino American Veterans Association, and that's where the Filipino community pretty much would have their events growing up. Both my sisters' wedding receptions were there, and that hall is still there, and so it serves Filipino veterans. Some of the founders are like Sal Flor, his father is one of the founders. So some of the people who are founders, their sons and daughters are a little bit older than me, but some of them I know. So there's some level of connectedness still of that second generation with some of us. But I think back then, the community wasn't as large. There wasn't a lot of centralized communities like here in Mira Mesa, Penasquitas, Paradise Hills, National City, and South Bay, Chula Vista. There's many more Filipinos, so our numbers have grown. I think part of what's different too is that when I was growing up, I didn't feel like there were a lot of role models. I think now there are more role models, and I think that helps. So I see more success in education, especially higher education. even though we all went to college, I'm the youngest of five, and I'm the only one who finished or got to the higher level of degree that I was able to do. So I finished the bachelor's degree, I got the master's, and got the doctorate.
So you did mention how education and whatnot has changed throughout the years. So in terms of education when you were younger, how represented did you feel in the curriculum presented to you?
Zero. Not really even at all. I remember when I first got involved with FONS, people were talking about that Filipinos were relegated to the Filipino quote-unquote insurrection. But I don't even remember that in terms of when I was growing up. I went to a small Catholic school in the neighborhood in Southeast San Diego. And so I don't remember. I remember, you know, I did have a good history teacher in political science, so to speak, but I don't remember a lot of that. So in terms of representation, and we're in terms of now, it's better, but it's still lacking. One of the things I was really determined was when I came here to this college, and we had such a large Filipino student population, it was the largest student group of color on campus, was to make sure we had curriculum that reflected. So we got activated the Filipino studies class, I got activated the Tagalog classes, and last year, I think it was, and finally, we have a Filipino studies certificate of performance. So that's a legacy, so to speak, that I'm proud of, that we were able to make some of that happen. But it wasn't until I got to college, my professor was Professor Tuye, and he taught a Philippine Philippine history and U.S. Filipino-American. It was more of a history class that I took, and that's where it wasn't again till college at Southwestern where my eyes were more opened, and knowing what our contributions were became more solidified, and I became more exposed to.
So what influenced you to actually go into teaching? Because I know you're teaching here at the Miramar College, and are you a department head for the Filipino Studies?
We don't have a full department, but I'm the only full-time faculty, yes, tenure faculty in the area, we don't have, like I said, a full department, but yes, but there's only two of faculty, we're not big enough for a department to be chair and all of that. But it was, I think, growing up and not being represented and not having role models. I ended up doing my dissertation on the influence of role models on ethnic identity. And when I started here, I didn't have my doctorate yet. I just had my master's. But when Professor Tia taught the first class, I think, in our district, but it had not been activated for a while. And so when I came here, it was like, okay, let's get that going. And then within 5 years, or I think less, can't remember, 92, and we started the class in 98, so a little bit more, we got the class activated. And then a few years later, we got the Tagalog activated. I don't teach Tagalog because I can't speak it. My parents spoke Ilocano growing up, and they were insisting, you know, they had that influence of, you know, educators kind of insisted that we just learn English. And so they followed that recommendation, or highly suggested direction. When I was younger, my family told me that I would pretend like I was a teacher in the patio and teaching class. So I always wanted to be in education. I knew that from a young age. Initially, I thought I wanted to be in high school. And then I knew I wanted to major in high school in psychology. But as I started taking more classes and learning more about ethnic studies, I actually was able to take an ethnic studies class in high school, which was back then, you know, almost kind of very, very avant-garde, so to speak. I mean, it was, and the teacher, she was Latina, and so she had a, we had different books by different authors, African, Maya Angelou, Farewell to Manzanar, so Asian, I think we had, those are the two that I remember the most, and we had two other ones, but that influenced me. I had a Latina counselor that came, I think, in my senior year. I tell this story, and I wrote about it in my dissertation, that I was in high school. I had the grades to go to college, but my parents didn't know how to go from high school to college, and my dad wasn't able to finish here. So they just kept, you know, making sure to get good grades, go to college, but the whole process. So I just figured I would go to the community college, and the high school counselor said, you know, why aren't you applying? And I said, well, I'm going to go to Southwestern. She said, you know, you had the grades. But I had a white male counselor before her who never, you know, never led me in that direction. It was just, I just knew I was going to go, and I had to pretty much figure out how. So some of the second generation that were older than me, they would come to the high schools, and they were working to try and influence a stronger sense of brown identity. So I got exposed to some of those people that were like role models who influenced me to kind of keep me on track. So I went to Southwestern, and I was able to transfer to San Diego State actually before I became a junior, because I had the grades and I just did the ACT, I think, at that time. And so I went earlier, but then I thought, you know, I actually liked Southwestern. So I came back, and I went between both campuses for a while, and I got a job at Southwestern. So I thought, you know what, I'll just stay at Southwestern and finish out and then go back to state. And so I did that. And there were always, I guess, people who were, I was at the right place at the right time, but many Filipino Americans who were influential in education, who, there were a couple of Filipinas, Pinays, who were in the master's program that I went into, who encouraged me to apply, who helped me with that process. So right out of undergrad, I got into a master's program at 22, graduated at 23 in terms, because it was a one-year master's program. And so I was, there were people who influenced me, sorry, that helped, I think. I didn't think I was going to get emotional. Sorry. I think just that I was thinking about, because my brothers and sisters, I mean, they all had the ability, but I think they didn't have some of people to help along the way.
So you did mention that you were interested in psychology from a young age. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the professions that you're in now and your place here at Miramar College in helping with their health services?
Mm-hmm. So I started at Miramar over 25 years now, and before coming here, I worked at San Diego State in counseling and psychological services. So after I got my master's in counseling, I decided I did not want to do high school counseling because I thought I was going to be different. I was going to be the high school counselor that was going to do what didn't happen with me until my senior year, but then I realized really they didn't, but I also wanted to do more personal counseling and more psychological counseling. I realized high school counselors didn't do that as I got into my master's program and as I got into the field in terms of psychology. So I worked at counseling. I got my license 3 years after I got my master's degree, so I was licensed at a very young age, at age 26. And then I was able to get the job at San Diego State, what was it, almost 2 years later, or so, I think. I was pretty young and got a job in counseling and psychological services doing this kind of work. So that was really my dream job. I wanted to be in education. I wanted to do more psychological counseling. And so I had got a part-time job. It was a part-time contract. And then budget cuts hit, and I got laid off. And so they were permanent layoffs, basically. And then that next year, I applied here. And again, there were people who knew that this campus needed, in terms of representation, but also because I had the qualifications and the background, encouraged me to apply. And so I applied. I got the first interview. I got the second interview with the president, and I got the job. But it was ironic because it was doing more academic counseling. And I thought, oh, this is part of why I didn't do the other thing. But I actually enjoyed it because I see psychology and counseling and therapy as a tool of empowerment, as education is a tool of empowerment. So I was, in some ways, again, got another dream. I was doing counseling, helping, empowering students. And then what was great about working in this setting is that we have professor status. So I went through the ranks of assistant, associate, and tenured it after assistant and that full professor. And I had the license already. So when I got the position, they knew that was my background. And when the college decided to build a mental health program, I got the call to do that. So I built the mental health program here. Over 10 years later now, we have two full-time. I have an adjunct, and we're about to hire one more full-time faculty member in the department.
So I noticed you speak really highly of role models and their importance to people in their mm-hmm. developing ages. In your experience, is there a connection between the presence of role models and one's mental health?
Yes, I think so. Because I think most definitely. So I was watching in the news this past week. They were talking about that West Point is going to graduate the highest number of most diverse class, the highest number of women, I think specifically African-American women. And so all the major networks did a piece on this statistic. And one of the things that each of them were saying is if you can see it, you can be it. So when you have role models who show you can get there, you can do it, you can be there, then those role models help an individual to aspire to feel better about themselves. I think in terms of mental health, part of having good mental health is having a sense of self-esteem, a sense of self-identity, a strong sense of self and wellness. So I think role models can help contribute to that.
As an educator and a psychotherapist here at a college with a much more diverse population mm-hmm. and something that is really reflective of the San Diego community, do you see yourself as a role model for a lot of the youth that you're involved with and that you speak to on a daily basis?
Yeah, I think so, and it's something, I guess something that I'm also proud of, because it's something I think I've worked hard. I've known the influence of how that's helped me, so I've been really committed to give back in that same way. I wrote a chapter in Philippine-American psychology, which is my own personal narrative, and that's how I end this. How I end that chapter, I talk about, sometimes I ask, why do I stay? Because I've had a lot of racism here, a lot of microaggressions, a lot of discrimination. I mean, I actually, I sued the college because their lack of hiring Filipino faculty. And part of it was in terms of, for me, I had taught psychology here as well, and so they were going to open a new psych position, and there are actually two new psych positions. And so I went to the department. I had been teaching psychology and said, would you support my transfer? And they, the majority of, I talked to, once I hit the number of five, there were seven, I thought, okay, I got the majority support. And I talked with the dean, and I talked with, I filled out a letter asking for a transfer. And the chair had said in a department meeting, because he knew that I was trying to garner the support, and he said in a department meeting, there's a certain short individual whose ancestors are out there in the Pacific who's trying to get a transfer, and we're not going to allow it to happen. The dean and I aren't going to allow it to happen. And someone who was in the department came back and told me that. And so I, first they told me, no, they're not going to let me transfer, just go ahead and apply. So I thought, okay, they already told me no. Why should I even apply? But I thought, okay, no, I'm going to go. I wanted to move into just teaching, not doing both teaching and this. And I told the dean, because I was supposed to go to a conference in Hawaii in March. I said, so when are the interviews going to be? Because I have this conference and I got funding, and I want to make sure I'll be able to be here if I get an interview. So he told me when the interviews were going to be. So I thought, okay. So I went ahead and applied. And then they had the interviews when I was going to be gone. And so when I asked for them to change the interview date, they declined. They denied me even the opportunity to interview. So prior to that, I had a number of other, but that was the last straw. I had a number of other things that have happened. So I filed a complaint with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, a discrimination complaint, and I went to all the way up to before trial, and it was a long process. It was a long, painful process, but what they did during that time frame was they hired at least, I think, five or six Filipino faculty. So for me, it was a win, even though what was ironic was they hired two white faculty for that position that I'd even get a chance to interview for, two white women who did not have a doctorate degree, who one of them didn't even make tenure, so they let her go. Whereas I had been teaching here and I had been working here all this time. So it was a painful process, and I'm not even fully recovered, because it just kind of ended some of that process a year or two ago, 16, 17, it's been a couple of years now. So it's been hard because they know I speak up, and they know I complain, and they know, and so they haven't made it real easy for me. When I wrote that chapter, it wasn't even to this level of discrimination, but I say in there that I feel like even if it's in some small way I can make a difference, at least I've done that. So I didn't go to trial because I just decided I was putting too much money into the case with the depositions and all of that. But what I did get was I got that certificate. I got a Filipino Studies Abroad class approved, and they had faculty. We hired, I think, about six faculty during that time frame. So it was like, okay. It was never about the money. It was about the discrimination for me.
So with all of these experiences that you've had here, how did all of this influence you into joining the Filipino American National Historical Society, or FONTS?
All of it, I think, contributed. I'm one of the founding members of the San Diego chapter, so we started the chapter in 1995. So it'll be our 20th year anniversary next 2025. Not fast with math. So I was one of the founding members in 1995, but prior to that, I had gone to my first FONS conference in 1994, and I had the founding president was Dr. Fred Cordova. I was able to have him come speak at a counselor's conference as the keynote. I belong to this organization that was about social justice and a representation of different four different main ethnic groups: Asian, African, Latino, and Native American. And so I was able to get Fred Cordova for the Asian. And so when I heard him and the work, heard about the work that they were doing, it was like, wow, this is somebody who was second generation like me, but he's older. You know, he wasn't an immigrant. And he was about some of the things that I experienced growing up in terms of influencing youth and young adults. And so that conference in 1994, it was in San Francisco. It was like, wow, this felt like home. It felt like a place that I could connect to people who looked like me, who valued the same things I valued, and were about telling our Filipino American history and our Filipino American narratives and stories. So the next year we started our chapter here in San Diego. And in the 2000s, I got elected to the board to be one of the board of trustees. I was actually the founding, I think, treasurer. And then in 2000, I became the president of San Diego chapter. And then I became, I got on the board, I think it was in 2004. And then I got elected to the executive board in 2012. As vice president, and then 2016 I became president.
As president, what does your position entail?
Much more than I had expected. Just now, just in terms of, I think, because of timing. When I was on the executive board, I actually coordinated the FON San Diego conference in 2014. And I'm biased, but it was one of the best conferences. That one, New York, was really good. And then Chicago wasn't that good. And it's going to be in Hawaii next year. But in terms of responsibilities, since I've been president, we opened our FONS National Museum in Stockton. We celebrated our 35th anniversary as a chapter. Since I've been on the executive board, we've inducted three more chapters, so we're up to 37 chapters now. I do quarterly meetings with the board of trustees, and I also have monthly meetings with the executives. So we have different subcommittees, which include organizational capacity, Filipino American History Month. Last year, I worked on a film that's about Filipino American History Month. It's a very short film that FONS had a major contribution to. So if you get a chance, look it up. And then also in my presidency, one of my major goals was to get the Congressional Gold Medal awarded to Filipino World War II veterans. So that was something that we helped accomplish, and my father was posthumously. I was able to receive the Congressional Gold Medal on behalf of my father for his service in World War II. So I flew to D.C. and was able to take part of that ceremony. And in these last 2 years, we basically had ceremonies. So I'm on the PhilVet Rep project, and we were able to get the Congressional Gold Medal awarded throughout the nation to different people, World War II veterans or their next of kin, throughout almost 50 ceremonies throughout the United States. So it's kind of been a lot. And now we're focused on succession planning. Our executive director is 87 now, years old. So Fred Cordova was a founding president, but the real brains was a Pinay. They're both brains. But it was Dorothy Cordova, his wife, Dr. Dorothy. They both received honorary doctorate degrees from Seattle U. It was her brainchild, so she's really the one who started it.
So how has your involvement here with FONS actually, in a way, affected or maybe even helped you here? here at your positions here at Miramar College?
In many ways, it's been my source of support when I've only kind of sometimes felt like I've been on an island here without level of support. Now that we've got more Filipino faculty, I feel like I have more support. There were other faculty of color, we would support one another, but now that there are more than you can count on one hand, that's helped. But Fons was sort of my source of empowerment. It was my source of connection. It was my source of connecting to my identity. So I think it was very helpful. We actually, it was because of Fons, we started a Filipino-American Student Scholarship Fund here. And so we just awarded, I just met with the student who we awarded the scholarship to last month. Those funds still, to this day, I mean, they're not large scholarships, but every little bit helps. we're still giving out the scholarships, and I think it's before Obama left office in 2015, the White House celebrated the first ever Filipino American History Month event, and he was the first president to recognize it. So when I was vice president, I went to the first ceremony, and then when I became president, I was able to speak at the White House at the Filipino American History Month event. So I think one of my mentees, she put it on her Facebook, and then they picked it up here on the campus. So they put it on the campus Facebook, and so people were like, oh, wow, Judy was at the White House. It was the Eisenhower building next to the White House, but it was on the White House grounds. I think it's helped a lot. It's given recognition to Filipino Americans here, and there are our numbers, our contributions, our history.
And how has your community involvement shaped you?
A hundredfold. A lot, I think. I've been very involved, I think, since, I always remember being involved in some capacity. My master's program is a master's program that focuses on multicultural competency and social justice, and so that was really a lot of the beginnings, and I got my master's over 30, I don't know how many years ago now, so... Since then, I have been involved with the community to some degree, and then when I got involved with Fons, I became very, very involved with the community, and we were able to do a lot of great things. One of the things also, since becoming president, we named the Lariat Leong Philip Veracruz Bridge off the Filipino-American Freeway, so we've been able to do some really good things during my community involvement. So it has shaped who I am in many ways.